Fanny Liao is the co-founder and chief product officer of Fable Security, leading product and technology for its human risk platform. Previously, she was an early team member and head of data science at Abnormal Security and led data science at Telepart, which was recently acquired by X/Twitter. She holds a PhD from UC Berkeley. Welcome to the podcast. So, Sani, tell me, when you were in college, did you aspire to go into this industry? What was your plan at that time?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. You know, when I went to college, I actually fell in love with math, specifically the kind of math that's not very practical at all. So my favorite courses were abstract algebra and model analysis. I did not think I would go into data science, but here we are today.
Yeah, it's a very practical product of math. I mean, I studied math myself in college, and it seemed like everyone was either going to go into computer science or actuarial science or perhaps teach. So math was your passion. And what did you hope to become when you were studying math?
You know, I don't think I actually thought about it very much. I think I'm always the kind of person where I make my decisions based on what I don't want to regret, you know, when I'm old and wrinkly. And I think at the time, I really loved math. I also really, really loved thinking about economic policies and development. So I actually come from a background where, you know, I was born in the 80s in China, where, you know, they had just opened it up. So I actually got to see firsthand how much government policies had an impact on economic outcomes. So it was very interesting in that as well. And that's actually what drove me to getting a PhD in business and public policy later on at Berkeley.
Very, very interesting. Just out of curiosity, because we're going to talk about this a little later on in the podcast. What was the ratio of males to female in your class at the time?
Oh, boy. There weren't many women. So I actually went to an all-women's college called Barnard College. That's part of Columbia University.
Yes.
But, in most of our math classes, there were maybe 2 to 4 women, right? Depends on the size of the class, probably 20 to 50 men.
Yeah. You know, that really, you know, the silver lining is it adds to your uniqueness factor, because having a female mind is different than having a male mind. And being in an industry of science and STEM-based careers, it gives you a bit of an edge because you think a little differently. And I always find that to play out in a fascinating way. Unfortunately, like STEM, it's become a little more so balanced out, still far from being 50-50, but you are seeing a lot more females head into like STEM-based careers. Now, onto security for just a moment. I think you're in the right industry, because if you were to look at security even 20 years ago, of course, it was always exceptionally important, but I think it's unprecedentedly more important now as we head towards decentralized structures, where the benefits in the past of having a centralized point is where you have a place to go to for recourse. If there's fraud on your account, you can go to the central authority and say, hey, I need to, you know, question these transactions. But now it's like there is no fallback option. And if your Bitcoin wallet is hacked, it's hacked. And I think security is a lot more in the spotlight today, perhaps comparable to like what it was being a software engineer maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you talk about security this way. I actually fell into security. When I got started in my career in tech, I actually did not know anything about cybersecurity at all. It just so happened that a couple of my, you know, colleagues that I worked very closely with and respected highly started a company back then called Abnormal Security. And you know, I thought, hey, you know, what better way to spend my career than working with people I highly respect? So I really kind of fell into it. And I think it was actually very clear right off the bat how interesting of a field it is. But, you know, now that I've actually worked it for a while, one thing I realized is that if you look at I would say like in the last couple of years, like this really, really crazy rapid rise of cybersecurity incidents, it actually became, I think for the first time, cybersecurity is actually one of those things where it went from a kind of insurance policy against rare events to something that directly drives the top line of a lot of different companies. And even kind of on a personal level, I will think about it on the same level of, you know, internet fluency became kind of part of what everyone's vocabulary has to be in the last, I would say, you know, 10, 20 years or so. And I would say in the next 10 years, what's going to happen is that two things, cybersecurity and AI has to become part of everyone's cyber fluency for us to really just even function in today's world.
Yeah. What did you find most fascinating about cybersecurity?
You know, I think when one just working in it, it's fascinating, right? Because it's just such an adversarial world. But cybersecurity is one of those unique ones where your adversarial is actually a very, very smart person on the other end who have access to the same type of technology tools, who are extremely motivated by the amount of money or influence they can gain because of the way they can mount cyber attacks.
Yeah.
So that actually creates this huge wave of essentially force that we have to fight against, right? Both on a personal level as well as organizational level, that we know is not going to go away, that is going to keep evolving, that's going to try to outdo us at every single step, that, you know, it's like we can't actually take it for granted anymore.
Of course. And it's like a nasty game of cat and mouse, where you can have the smartest science, you can have the best encryption structures in the world, but a system is only as good as its weakest component. You don't need to be the smartest person in mathematics to get into a system. You just need to know a little bit of social engineering sometimes, because the people who are guarding valuable data are sometimes the biggest weakness to the system. You can call in pretending you're working with the guy, the UPS guy who came in this morning, and you get a little bit of code that's in the back of the computer, or you ask the person in the front who's poorly trained, and all of a sudden you've bypassed like a $1 billion security infrastructure.
Yeah.
Talk about how complex this playing field is becoming.
Yeah. You know, the thing is that I hear this a lot, actually, in this industry, especially, you know, in the human risk space, which is a space that Fable is building our company in. People will say that human is the weakest link. But the fact of the matter is that it's actually, you can't just take it for face value, right? So if you think about it, you know, most of us, we're technologists, you know, we live and breathe software code. We think about systems in a about problems in a way of like, how can we build technical solutions for them? And I think one of the things you observe in the security space is that a lot of the builders in the space are thinking about problems as in, can I build a technical tool to solve that? Can I turn something on and off? But the thing is that humans are not like machines. You can't turn a human on and off, right? If there's a vulnerability found on a iOS device, you can patch it. It's gone. You can't actually turn a human on and off, patch a human right away like that. So it actually makes it really hard to be able to tackle a lot of these human level opportunities for attackers to abuse.
Right.
But the thing is that just because you can't treat a human like a machine doesn't mean that you can't actually change behavior, right? It just means that the previous approach hasn't worked. And if you, just on face value, right? If you say, hey, humans not like machines, no one's going to disagree with that, right? Everyone's going to say, of course, I'm not a machine. You can turn me on and off. But the thing is that behavior change is also not a myth. It's a science in places like ad tech, in social media, right? Places like Instagram have figured out how to, you know, glue someone's eyeball for 4 hours onto a screen. And that's literally just behavior change as it is. So I think in security, you know, we've kind of come to the point where we'll say, hey, humans are the weakest link. You can't patch humans. You can't change behaviors. But it really is a technology problem. The kind of tools we have in cybersecurity today to actually help humans address these points where humans are manipulated is just really poor. I think it's a technology problem. We absolutely can change behavior. It just hasn't been done well yet.
Yeah, we like to know things behave systematically. So that gives us control. But with humans, we're not systematic.
No.
And there's an element of unpredictability that makes people who do good work a little on edge. So I completely understand that perspective. Now, we talked about the three-pronged revolution at our doorstep. Can you break down where all this is heading? The concerns that are around quantum cryptography. When you think about the evolution of AI, no matter where it's going, it's clear to us that it'll be able to surpass human intelligence in various capacities, and it's to some extent it already has, and it's operating at a speed that's way faster than we can. So think of, even if you had like one person working for 1,000 years on a problem, you'd get really interesting results. But think of if that person was 1,000 times smarter working for 1,000 years. It's this like 2 degrees of freedom of just productivity. Mm-hmm. And it's advancing faster than Moore's law. We're just losing control at the rate of change here, compounded with the fact that we're heading into a world with quantum computing and a lot of our current data structures are just going to be broken down really simply. Mm-hmm. How do you see all this heading in a world where everything exists online?
I think we don't have to, you know, the thing is that I think there's a lot of people postulating around what's going to happen around productivity in the end state, right, in the limit. But I think there's a couple things that's in play here. One is that, like, in the very present, in the next 5 years even, there's no question that if you look at both from an individual level as well as organizational level, the people who are the first to learn how to use AI effectively, the individuals, as well as the organizations who learn to incorporate AI into their workflow effectively, are going to be the ones with a competitive edge. So there's yeah. no question about that, right? So on that level, I think, you know, aside from like where the society is going, kind of in that limit state, by individual level, this is really kind of changing how we're operating. So for, you know, a lot of like kind of our day to day, when you think about, you know, I get a lot of parents asking me, hey, you know, given where AI is going right now, should I even be putting my kids through school? Right? Like, what are the skills I should be? But these are fair questions, you know, because you look at how AI is changing how we work.
It's pulling at the heartstrings of our own understanding of where we derive value, because we have this intrinsic benevolence of machines. And even though we understand the threat they pose, the only question we ask is how can we accomplish this sooner? And when anything that's unique about ourselves is being replaced, then what's the point of going to work when something can work 1,000 times faster and 1,000 times quicker than us? It's concerning.
It is. But then if you look at what's actually happening day to day, right, you kind of realize that it's actually less scary than it's more exciting, if you will. Right. Like the type of work that AI is able to do, it's going to keep changing. But like what we're seeing day to day is that there's stuff that used to be menial or things that I used to, you know, bang my head against the wall because I didn't know how to create like a draft of something, or I needed to review a contract and it's just so boring to look through these.
Right.
These are the perfect uses of AI, right? Where I can now kind of free up my time to do other things. So
correct.
I think, you know, like on a kind of microscopic level, on individual level, we're kind of seeing that, right? And that part is actually way more exciting than scary, because like I, as an individual, there's things I want to do that is not like a mechanical computational task or even something I can kind of reason through with that AI system. It requires like a level of, you know, thinking through the different trade-offs, right? Thinking through things that like playbooks, that path to solve a problem that there isn't a playbook for yet,
right,
that, you know, this AI actually frees me up to be able to do something like that. So I think, you know, in the short term, right, like I'm actually not worried about it. It's very exciting. There's like, I feel like I just get to do much more higher leverage stuff because of AI.
Correct. If you're above the AI curve in the sense that you've doubled down or you're on your uniqueness factor, what makes you exceptional and what is noise? And if you can patternize and delegate all the noise, you've got this PhD level student right beside you available full time. I completely agree with you. The concern truly isn't about today. The concern is more about even in a shorter time frame than we anticipate, perhaps just a few years. And I'll give you, I'll put my point into perspective here. And this ties into security quite nicely. A part of why I'm comfortable with my password to my bank account is not because the protocols for protecting my bank account are impossible to break through. they're just highly inconvenient to brute force and guess all these different permutations of my potential password will take 100 years. And I'm confident that there's no one out there who cares more about my bank account than 100 years of their time. And somehow we all agree that that's a way for us to go about our lives. But the problem now is that think of having a million really smart AI bots full time rattling, we call this in the cyber world, rattling on your doorknob. You know how like you have a server and you get thousands of pings in an hour? No one cares about, no one necessarily cares about your data, but these are automated processes that go and they rattle every digital doorknob to see who forgot to lock their keys. And then if the door is open, they'll come into your house and steal whatever they can. And think of having millions of those with superhuman intelligence. Not just rattling your doorknob, but these are ninjas that can go on, climb onto a 20-story building and sneak into a tiny window. And that's where my concern is. It's like today, yeah, it's all great. We can leverage this LLM to do our homework and to fix our grammar. And yes, what makes us special, we do more of. But there's going to be this inflection point where our predictive power is completely out of control. For like the past 100 years, starting with our ability to project the trajectory of bombs in World War I, where we came out with the first computer, like, yes, that was a great start. And then we had this linear progress of growth with Moore's Law, and we're able to make computers smarter and smarter. And we had some predictive power. We kind of knew where things were going. Think of like just maybe 20 years ago, we would talk about AI. Even like 5 years ago, we talk about AI.
It's a different AI period.
Yeah, and every week you're like, oh my God, this update's crazy. So yeah, it's a scary world because everything's online. Even with like quantum computers, where even if today we move all of our encryptions to quantum safe cryptography, you have garbage dumps of what we thought was gibberish encrypted data that we don't care if there's a man in the middle grabbing these packets are garbage, they're encrypted. But what happens when we take encryptions that are done on primitive structures, and in 5-10 years from now everyone's got a quantum computer, we throw them through a quantum computer, and we're looking at treasure troves of data, and they can use that data in all sorts of ways that we don't anticipate to compromise data we have today or structures that are quantum safe. Large point here, but I'm just various angles that are just concerning for the next 5 to 10 years. So you're in the perfect industry because people are going to be begging for your help.
Yeah, I think I see where you're coming from. And the thing is that I kind of think of it almost as, you know, if you look at like, let's say, this is almost like kind of like physical crime in a little bit, right? Like, you know, I live in a perfectly safe neighborhood, but the thing is that it really doesn't stop anyone from, if they really wanted to target me, come to my door, figure out how to break into my all my layers of security, all that stuff. There's actually not that much difference between the physical type of attack we're talking about as well as the online one, if someone was really determined enough. Right. But if you look at what's actually happening on the ground, is that crime, much often than not, it's actually an act of opportunity, right? So, you know, when we a couple of years ago, when our garage got broken into, what the police came over and told us was that, you know, the best way to deter someone from doing this again is to make sure you have lights installed around your house. It makes your house like a harder target. So we're actually kind of seeing this play out in the online world as well. It's like, can someone go and brute force their way through, you know, to all your accounts if they really wanted to? Probably. Can you make yourself a very unlikely target? Yeah, there's a lot you can do to make yourself a very unlikely target. From, you know, making, like, let's say, don't reuse your passwords all over the place, right? Always use a password manager so that everything is, you know, randomized across accounts. Or better yet, right, like, don't use passwords. Use a passkey whenever possible. These are all the things that actually seem like really trivial, but these are really the equivalent of putting lights over your garage that makes you a much harder target for these attackers.
That was a great answer. So can you tell me a little bit more about what you're doing today?
So I'm actually a very paranoid person, especially since I think in the last couple years since I spent, you know, like at Abnormal Security, we spend a lot of time analyzing all kinds of attacks that come in. And I think one of the biggest lessons I learned is that, wow, there's people who's really motivated out there where if they can sniff what weakness, they'll break in. So what I'm actually kind of, what I actually advocate for, and I tell this to all my friends, everyone I run with, everyone I literally have a coffee with, is like install the lights over your garage for your own online presence. So make sure that you're using a password manager. Make sure that your partner's using a password manager. Make sure that your mother is using a password manager. Because guess what? Like, our parents are actually some of the biggest targets. But in addition to that, make sure you have MFA enabled and passkey, better yet, if possible, on your most sensitive accounts. So I'm talking about your workspace, your bank accounts. A lot of people don't think about it.
Can you explain to us what a passkey is? How that's different than a password?
Yeah, a password, everyone knows, right? It's kind of basically you put in your username, you have a unique, and then you have like some type of alphanumeric string that says, hey, you know, I have access to this account. Once, you know, what people started realizing that, like, hey, it's easier for me to steal someone's password through social engineering them. So what happened after that is that, you know, a lot of companies started coming out with this thing called MFAs, multi-factor authentication. So, this is basically a second way for a person to say, hey, I'm really me, right? Look, there's a second way for me to prove that I am really me. So this MFA method, it started with, you know, things like, you know, SMS, right, based codes or email based codes. Once we had that, attackers realized that, like, hey, I can actually social engineer my way into someone's account by calling them up, pretending to be from IT help desk and get their MFA code. So once that happened, then a lot of, you know, these security companies started rolling out with things like one-time passwords. So you'll get an app like a Google Authenticator, right, or Duo, where, you know, once you log in, you kind of get provisioned this six-digit code that usually is only alive for like a few seconds, right? That's only accessible to you on your phone for you to prove who you are. Attackers figure out how to social engineer that as well. We've seen all these voice-based phishings where they were to kind of bypass that. So then the latest way that a lot of, especially what we see is that, you know, workspace accounts like Google and Microsoft has started coming out with a passkeys. So these are essentially biometric fingerprints that proves who you are through either a face scan or a fingerprint.
That your unique markers say on your finger translate to a very specific hash code?
Exactly. So it's
how is that so consistent where they can get the same exact hash code every time? And I know that we're getting into the weeds here, but if there's a podcast answer.
Yeah. It's a combination of basically your face, right, as well as your device. So basically what you're able to kind of say is that, like, what it's resolving is that, like, hey, I can confirm through kind of like this facial recognition as well as the device that I know that it's the same person who's authenticating. Mm. So it's a lot stronger than a one-time code, because attackers can now actually social engineer you into giving up your face.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. So if you were to go back in a time machine and you knew that you were going to have the position that you have today, would you have studied math? Or I think you said you studied pure math or abstract mathematics. Or would you have taken a degree in cybersecurity, and why?
I don't think I would have taken a degree in cybersecurity, because cybersecurity is, I don't know if it actually even existed as its own field when I was in college. Mm. And two is that I think a lot of what's happening in cybersecurity, a lot of the advances are actually being made in the field and not in academia. Now, I know in academia, there's a lot of, you know, work being done in cryptography, but if you're looking at kind of adversarial attacks, right, like how to counter these, I think in the industry, you definitely get way more exposure to what people are actually doing and abusing in order to, you know, get into people's accounts.
So you would have studied, sorry?
So the answer, the short answer is that, like, I don't think I would have studied cybersecurity 20 years ago, when I was choosing what I would study. But, you know, at the same time, I think this is always a hard debate because I think I ask myself this question a lot because I have a lot of, you know, kids with younger, with kids who's like a friend with kids who's in school, who's choosing what they want to do.
Right.
And it's a hard decision, you know, because like, how do you know at 20 year old, what do you want to do? Right. Yeah. The world is so big.
I love that you're saying that. And that's exactly why I asked you the question.
Because is that right?
We don't know what we want to go into. Yeah. Because like, I always wonder. My background, I studied math and computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found interesting was that I felt mathematics was more helpful for computer science than computer science was for computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of like when you're learning a new concept, let's say in calculus, you have these, like in your math book, you have 8 different steps. So it gives you one problem where it just gives you exposure to the concept. And then each problem gets incrementally harder. And then if you can do the last problem, you really understand the concept really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the question becomes, do you want to slowly build up or do you want to just spend 5 hours on the last problem and then you'll have a complete deep understanding? The point I'm trying to make here is that I felt that computer science was in the ecosystem of computer science, but I felt understanding the mathematical undertones and mathematical constructs for computer science gave me like a top-down approach to computer science. And I feel like when you study like physics and math, like the raw sciences, sometimes you're better suited. And we talked about the uniqueness factor. You always want to have a unique edge. And approaching an industry with an unorthodox path, I think is really helpful. Because science is one thing, but solving problems that exist today requires innovative mindset, requires engineering, requires thinking of problems that other people haven't thought of yet.
Yep.
And for example, being the only female in your industry and, you know, like approaching biology with a background in computer science, stuff like that really does get the mind thinking in an interesting way. And that's why I asked you that question. I always said, if you were to go back, would you have studied cybersecurity specifically, or would you have taken something a little more unique? And I think you kind of gravitated towards the fact that you would have redone math.
I would have redone math. But you know, I think this is actually an important point you're bringing up. This is something I've been thinking about a lot, which is, you know, there's like this notion of if you're making a decision, do you make it based on the ultimate goal you're trying to get to, right? Or do you make it based on, you know, what feels right to you at that moment, even though you're unclear where the goal is. And this kind of matters in the sense that like, if you knew when you were 18 years old, right, that you want to be a computer scientist, maybe it makes sense to just study computer science.
Right.
But if you, but most 18 year olds,
it's a chicken and egg situation, 100%.
Right.
Because the more you know what you want to do.
It is. But like the fact of the matter is that we always think we know more than we do, right? At 18 year olds, by the way, think that they know everything, which,
it's,
you know,
called
I
the
think...
Dunning-Kruger effect, when you know very little about something.
Get.
Yeah, it's this weird relationship. And then the more you know, the more you're humbled in a crowd to think you don't know. And that's usually intelligence certainly comes with humility. Yes,
it is. But you know, I think that's where it's actually a little dangerous to make decisions optimizing for something you think you want, kind of like down the road, and being so myopic about like, this is what I want. Because the fact of the matter is that like, we actually don't know everything, right? So you kind of have to rely on a couple principles for making these decisions. I think, you know, there's totally people out there who, you know, I think studying computer science is absolutely the right thing. They love it, right?
100%.
Like, this is where the passion is. It's great. But just recognize that, like, not everyone needs to know the answer. And it's okay to not know exactly what you want to do and to say, hey, you know, I'm going into this. Like, this is the beginning of my life. I get to do anything I want in this world. So maybe I want to go study something I really love and I'll figure out what to do with it later. Right.
Yeah.
And that's totally okay.
No, you're so spot on. And I think the secret here is to two things. First of all, when I approach something like college, I'm thinking of what can I learn from college that would be the hardest to learn anywhere else? Learning how to program in PHP, I can probably learn that on YouTube quite simply. Learning advanced mathematics might be a little harder. I'd want to be forced in a situation. So let me pick the thing that I'll have the hardest time learning anywhere else. And I think that's a good place to start. But also, you need to have a very narrow frame. in some capacity where it's like, I don't necessarily know if I want to become a psychologist, but the secret for me here is to, if I'm in a course, let's just say, and I'm in my first year of psychology and I'm like really not confident with my long-term direction, the secret is not to let your long-term direction hinder your decisions today. You're mm-hmm. building this castle, which is your life, and you have a brick in front of you. Instead of worrying about the chandelier on the 10th floor, you worry about placing this brick perfectly in this spot where it makes the most sense right now. And I'll tell you why. Because even if you don't become a psychologist, the concepts you learn in psychology could be leveraged in a multitude of ways, in ways that you can't anticipate today. You're studying computer science. You might not want to become a programmer. There are a lot of people in my courses who are doing computer science, and they just didn't want to do it. But mm-hmm. computer science helps you far beyond the confines of computer science. They teach you how to think. They teach you how to hold an argument. They teach you how to be precise when you communicate. And that can be leveraged in an infinite amount of ways that you can't even anticipate where you are right now. That's kind of how I think of it. Pick the hardest thing to do at the time so you have the least amount of regret and make the most of the opportunity directly in front of you. And somehow it works out.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that our entire conversation now devolved into talking about advices we will give our younger selves. I would say this, you totally reminded me of the worst advice I've ever received in my life. The worst advice I've ever received in my life was when I was in grad school. Well, actually, I was preparing for grad school, and someone I actually looked up to, told me this advice of, I don't remember what was the decision I was trying to make, but basically the advice to me was choose the path of least resistance. And I ended up doing that, and it ended up being like the biggest regret of my life. And what I kind of realized after the fact, right, it's like everything turned out okay. But what I ended up learning after the fact was that it's never about getting to a point the fastest way, choosing the path of least resistance. The most important thing I can do for myself is choosing something that I really love and believe in. And if I suck at it, that's okay. But the fact that if I really love it, that means I'm much more willing to work at it like day and night. And if it's something I'm going to work harder than everybody else on, right? Yeah. Like I can only do that if I really love it. And if I'm going to work harder than everybody else at it, after 10 years, I'll get pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So
often do you fall in love with something that's super easy? You fall in love with things that challenge you, that make you redefine how you see yourself, that are complicated. That delta I get like a week before my exams in college, where I crammed in a semester's worth in 7 days, that's a part of me that I'm addicted to. Where if I don't have that later on in my life, if I'm going through my work life and there's a patternized process of just low brain work that's repetitive, I really question if I'm heading in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so now, I want you, now we talked about the past, I want you to talk about your company and how you see the future of your company in a 10 years from now world of cybersecurity.
Yeah. So I actually think of, by the way, like our space, the space that we're building in is that we're building a human risk management platform. So what that means, for folks who's not familiar with Fable is that we work with organizations to go and identify who are the people who are at the most amount of risk within the organization, whether it's people who have a lot of access, people who have a lot of access and have been, taking risky behavior, right? Any combinations of those things. Once we identify that, then we go and engage with those employees directly to correct this behavior and reduce risk for the business. The reason we actually got started in this, and this kind of goes into your North Star question, is that in 2023, if you remember, September 2023 was when the MGM resource breach happened. And that was kind of like a big moment where we realized that this is a place where attackers are very adversarial. Traditionally, most companies think about human risk as, hey, can I protect people against, phishing over email? This is something that it happened over voice. So it's nothing you can cut down from an email perspective. And what we realized is that, hey, attackers will always be adversarial. They'll get around all your technical controls to the human. And everybody absolutely need a very effective layer of control for the humans. And that does not exist right now. So that's what inspired us to start Fable. So for Fable, for us, what's really meaningful for us, if we are doing a good job, is that once we start working with a company, we want to see that at that company, the number of human cost incidents has dropped from, you know, if there used to be 100, now less than 5.
Yeah. So it's like, to be good at cybersecurity is really not just about zeros and ones. It's so much more than that.
Absolutely. I mean, with all the AI stuff, you at the end of the day, we still are not living in a post-human world, right? Like humans are going to learn to use AI more effectively,
right.
But human attackers will find ways to get to the human by bypassing all your technical controls. So, and we need a very effective way to be able to actually address the human level of risk by treating humans as, you know, basically not treating humans as machines, right? We
right.
have to actually meet humans where they are at, be able to affect behavior change in a way that actually works for people.
Yeah. Okay. So Sani, someone is listening to you and they're like, I'm convinced. All right. I agree. So what would be like the first piece of advice you give to them to avoid the biggest potential root for issues?
So there's two sides I will actually advise, right? Whether you work with Fable or not, it's, you know, you make your decision. But for every single organization, I think there's two things on the human side that like everybody should take very seriously. Number one is, this is kind of our discussion earlier about making yourself a hard target. You should absolutely have the basic level of controls on your human layer. So everybody should have a password manager. You should be using strong MFA for all your critical apps, period, right? Like there should not be an exception for that, because this is, we know attackers find these weaknesses. So that's number one. The second thing is that, you know, security is now actually a driver of business top line, right? Like if your customers think that you don't take security seriously, why would they trust you with their data, right? Why would they trust you with, you know, being one of their vendors? So security actually is really, really important right now. But inside, you know, each company, security is not actually taken seriously everywhere yet, right? Security does have like in general, a brand problem within a lot of companies. So I think I think a lot of companies do think seriously about what is the brand of the security team internally. Are you, you know, do people see you as a detractor of productivity? Do people see you as someone who really kind of understand the risk of the business intimately and are recommending interventions that's really appropriate for the business that actually addresses the meaningful risk for the business? But like that brand is actually super, super important for security team to actually do their job properly within a company and actually drive that business top line. So I think, you know, the second part is that like I would actually advise every security team to think very seriously about what is their internal brand and how can they actually boost their brand, because this is going to be at the end of the day better for security team and better for the business in general.
Interesting. Now, Sani, you have a very impressive and unique path. You got a PhD in mathematics as a female, and now you're at the forefront of a cybersecurity company. There are many females out there who have great minds and they want to pursue STEM-based careers, but there's an element of intimidation where it's like, hey, this looks like a very different ecosystem. It's either I'm like going to be one of the only females like you were in your classroom. What would be the number one piece of advice you'd give to them to get started in a path like you have?
You know, I would say it's not easy being a woman for reasons that I think it's a little different from what most people would assume. It's not that, you know, when I go out there, I'm being discriminated in my math classes or in cybersecurity, right? It's at the end of the day, you can show up, you can say, hey, I am here. I know what I'm talking about. You need to take me seriously. Otherwise, it's your problem. But I think a lot of times it's really just don't overthink it. I would say, you know, if it's something that you love, just go for it. Don't worry about how other people are perceiving you. Don't worry about, you know, if you may or may not get an opportunity. If you're applying for a job, right, don't worry about if you satisfy, you know, all the different 20 different criteria out there. If it's something you want, go for it, right? And it's okay to fail. It's okay to be rejected. But the first thing we have to do is literally just like put ourselves out there. And, you know, there's going to be people who may be a detractor, but at the end of the day, right, like it's their problem. And the only thing we have control over are our own lives.
Right. And sometimes, like, the thing about yourself that you believe in that's least understood by everyone around you is often the most precious thing that you'll come to realize that'll be a big part of your success. It's what makes you different than everyone. And especially in a world where, if you look at something like AI, is just the aggregate. It's your B+ aggregate. It's your mean value of all the data out there. It is the safest bet. It's going to give you an answer that's going to have the highest probability of being accepted by the person asking it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's being washed out. So whatever uh-huh. is unique about you, that's what you want to double down on. Because that, I call it your uniqueness factor. And that'll give you an edge in the AI world. And that'll give you an edge in whatever industry you head in.
Yeah, absolutely. Do not worry about fitting in, right? If kind of exactly yeah. like you said, if you're fitting in, you're average. Why would you want to yeah. be average?
Exactly. Sani, so how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, if anyone's interested, wants to learn more about Fable, it's very easy to find us at fablesecurity.com. You know, I personally love to actually talk about everything around, you know, AI, cybersecurity, personal choices in life. And you can easily find me on LinkedIn as well.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure as well. Thank you for having me.